This morning will be from Uncommon Wisdom, the chapter called Memory. When we were very young and still trying to make sense of the world around us, our minds struggled to absorb all the diverse information that they received through the five senses and to organize it in such a way that we could retain it for future use. We gradually learned to lump similar sorts of things into categories under headings for easy access. Eventually, these general categories began to represent an array of variations on a common theme referred to by a certain name or word. Take trees, for example. Very early on, we began to recognize shapes of light and color which we could distinguish from other visual forms. We knew they existed, but we didn't know how to tell them apart. Finally, someone pointed out a long brown stem with a green bushy top and called it a tree. They made us repeat the word over and over until the sound stuck in our mind. Pretty soon, the sound of the word tree became a symbol in our mind for all visual images that had a similar shape and color. As we discovered more and more trees in our world, they were all placed under the same iconic symbol, tree. In the same way, we soon learned to distinguish and then recognize all the visual objects in our environment. They, in turn, were all given words to symbolize their unique characteristics. Symbolizing is a way of simplifying. For the most part, it's necessary for the mind to simplify the great variety of incoming sense data. Mental symbols are nature's way to store an enormous amount of information, knowledge, and understanding within a very limited mind capacity. In other words, creating symbols facilitates the task of dealing with a lot of complex information. When we group a large amount of information under one symbol, like tree, we can then deal with just that symbol without the need to consider the totality or the complexity of what it represents. We have a name for it, and that's enough. The complexity can be devilish, but if we can name the devil, we have defeated him. In other words, we have been able to grab a hold of him in some meaningful way. Any object of consciousness is made up of bits and pieces, called sankharas, that act like pixels on a screen. We don't see the individual pixels. Instead, what we see is a mental object distinct from its background. But the object that we distinguish in this way is, in fact, just a symbol representing the complexity of all the bits and pieces that comprise it. We use such symbols all the time. Our minds are absolutely riddled with them. They are part of the fundamental way we think. We have to use symbols for thinking because the complexity of phenomena is so vast that the mind just isn't capable of holding it all at once. So we focus on certain prominent aspects of every experience and turn those into symbols representing the whole. But these objects are more than just visual images in our lives. They also have a certain emotional impact on us, often associated with the experiences we had in relation to them. Sometimes the experience was positive, sometimes negative, and sometimes neutral. In whichever case, our future perceptions are then colored by an emotional overlay as well. With more time and more experience, the complexity of our perceptions increases. Depending on our emotional state and other conditions, seeing a tree might make us feel happy or frustrated or indifferent. The symbol is still the same, but it has multiple shades of meaning. And because no two individuals are exactly alike in the way they perceive things, the words and symbols that represent those objects may have significantly different meanings from one person to the next. When we are first introduced to a new place, much of what we perceive is unfamiliar. So we begin to look around and observe the general nature of that environment until we can mentally consign the whole of it to a symbol for convenient future reference. It's like putting all of our observations under one heading in a directory. Then we need only access that heading when we want to refer to that place. There will be a word symbol, but there will also be emotional content within ourselves. Creating symbols is essentially because it frees memory to be used in all sorts of other ways. Otherwise, if we had to remember everything, our brains would have to be enormous to hold it all. But there is also a fundamental disadvantage to mental symbolizing, because, in the end, we tend to deal only with the symbols and not with the reality. As a matter of fact, we begin to give the symbols a reality that they don't possess. This can very easily be a cause for more delusion. For instance, we take something very complex, like another person, and give that person a name. Our notion of that person revolves around the emotional reaction his name tends to evoke. That notion is a very static view of another human being. In truth, the reality of human beings is very complex. We have a general idea of the people we know, but that idea doesn't take into account the changes that are constantly taking place inside them. We have symbols for everything, including our emotional states. When a particular emotion state comes up, we recognize it because we remember it under a certain symbolic heading. It's hard to define these internal symbols. Often they are just feelings, but we know them quite distinctly. That is, we know what the feelings symbolize to us. But that doesn't mean that we know their reality. We often think we understand something, when in truth, instead of catching hold of what's really happening, we've merely caught hold of a symbolic representation of it. What actually happens is invariably quite complex. What's really happening is more like a whirlpool of constant change. If we try to resist change and remain static, we will miss the truth every time. If we can just watch it closely, we will see that everything is part of this whirlpool of changing phenomena. So we let it follow its natural tendency. We should try to be aware that there is a vortex of activity occurring in and around us all the time. We experience this, but because our minds are not quick enough to catch up with the constant arising and ceasing of phenomena, we have to reduce the whole law to something simple enough for our minds to latch onto. Thus, we create a symbol. For instance, a motor car. The word motor car is just a symbol. What is a car, actually? It's an assemblage of 100,000 different parts. Nevertheless, we represent it with that one symbol. Similarly, a house is composed of countless bits and pieces. We refer to it as a house because our minds just aren't capable of handling the complexity of what's really there. We just can't hold it all in our minds at the same time, so we have to simplify. The symbols in our minds change and adapt according to circumstances. We have a range of symbols that can adapt to fit different situations. Part of the symbol is the form. Part of it is the use, and part of it is the location. Symbols go even further by isolating an object and separating it from the whole of its background. For instance, we identify one tree out of a whole forest. Why do we identify that one particular object as the tree and the rest as the forest? It's just our way of grasping the situation in terms of cause and effect. The same principle applies to internal objects, like emotions. We try to get a handle on them by giving them a name. By that token, we think we understand them, but it is important to realize that the naming and labeling of such things does not truly represent their reality. Internal phenomena, like emotional states, must be carefully observed. We should also be willing to question them within ourselves. We mustn't simply dismiss them by saying, "That's hatred, that's greed." We must look at them as they occur inside. Look at those mental states just the way they are, regardless of what we call them. Try to understand their real nature apart from the name. We should look at the symbols in our own minds and try to understand how they distort reality. Being mere symbols, they do not represent the truth. Therefore, they are, in a sense, false. By investigating the symbols, we come to realize that we have views about those mental constructs which we are very attached to. This attachment sets up a tension in the mind based on the possibility that they may fade from memory. Thinking about people and events in the past is a way of refreshing the memory. We do this because we don't want to let go, because we have a lot of attachment to them. I am growing old now, and my memory is not as good as it used to be. I find some advantages in this because the past seems to be rather vague, so I don't think about it much. Because of that, the attachments are dropping away. Having a fading memory is a disadvantage in some ways, but it also has its good points. The symbols we accumulate to structure the world around us are bound up with the faculty of memory. Memory is a database of all of our previous experiences that runs like a continuous thread through the pattern of our mental activity. The data formed from memory comes in through the five senses. It's the senses that tell us what to remember. An enormous amount of our thinking is based on memory. When we see or hear something, we identify it by comparing it to remembered impressions. Our present existence may be associated with external sensations, but those sensations have to be identified and interpreted in the light of past sensations. Once we recognize a particular sensation, we think about it, which again relies on the faculty of memory. For that reason, memory is an essential part of our perceptions. We can observe how some symbols in our mind tend to fade away over time. They may be little used or outdated, but as soon as they start to disappear, up comes our self-identity, saying, "I mustn't let that one go." So we begin to think about it, in the process strengthening and reestablishing it in the mind. We refresh our memories by thinking. Quite a lot of our discursive thought is directed towards that aim. We build up our view of the world from the internal sensations we experience. The impressions we receive are stored in memory. We've accumulated an enormous amount of data dating back to when we were children. As we grew up, we became very concerned about learning everything we could about our environment, mainly for the sake of our own security in the shifting landscape of life. When we know something and can put a name to it, we find reassurance in that knowledge. If any changes occur in our world, we immediately recognize them and make note of them because changes may signal imminent danger. We instinctively want to be on top of every deviation from the norm that takes place. In the process, we are constantly updating our memories with fresh information. As new changes occur, old information immediately becomes part of the past. Memory refers to the past. Because of that, memory itself is the basis of our concept of time. The time that we know is the past. We don't know the future. We predict that. We only predict the future on the basis of what's happened in the past. And we can access the remembered past only by reflecting on it in the present. So we can say that memory is at the center of our views on time. We rely on the past for a sense of security in a changing world. We become very attached to what we remember because it gives a sense of continuity to our lives. It's as though if we can remember something, it still somehow exists. Although we can't actually go back in time, there is comfort in recalling the memory of it. Memories easily become a refuge from the uncertainty of impermanence. But such a refuge is based on neither truth nor stability. We have to accept that nothing is permanent, that everything is constantly changing from one moment to the next, and therefore we should not be deceived into thinking that our memories contain anything in which we can put our trust. Instead of getting caught up in the content of our memories, we should examine the nature of the faculty of memory itself to understand how the process works. Memory is made up of an alphabet soup of images, concepts, and symbols that compare incoming sense data with past experience in attempt to recognize where it belongs in the inner world of known perceptions. In other words, memory matches present perceptions to past experiences and labels them accordingly. We recognize a tree because we have the characteristics of a generic tree stored in our memory. This, in turn, is based on a commonly shared interpretation of what that particular form represents. But the designation tree is merely a symbolic substitute for reality, not the reality itself. We suppose that by naming it, we understand what it is, but the reality is quite different from the name. When it comes to discussing a topic like meditation, difficulties in communication are bound to arise because we all have our own ideas and our own unique inner experiences. In using language to convey our meaning, we have to turn those concepts into spoken words. Words are sounds that others pick up and turn into meaningful concepts inside themselves. They take the spoken sound, the word, and refer to it to memory to find out their own understanding of it. That understanding depends largely on the listener's background. Even with a similar background in Buddhist practice, we can never be sure that any two people will understand a word in the same way. One of the greatest difficulties in explaining mind development to people in the West is that they don't have the advantage of a Buddhist background to help them grasp a basic understanding of common Buddhist terms and concepts. The English language just doesn't have the words needed to properly explain the teaching to them. That is, the words and the concepts for what's being discussed just aren't stored in their memory. Language is necessary for communication, but it is also a minefield for misunderstanding. It's useful to study how language works, how it conveys meanings. Basically, language is a symbolic process. When we think of an object, we are reminded of the word for that object, which has specific connotations attached to it. But the connotations for the same word may differ between the speaker and the listener, which easily causes misinterpretations to arise. The same word, the same symbol, conveys different shades of meaning to different people. When speaking about physical objects in the world, like trees, the differences are unlikely to be a problem. We can point to a tree, but when it comes to concepts like virtue or concentration or wisdom, there is nothing concrete that we can point to. Because of that, it is very easy for people with limited genuine experience in these matters to misunderstand the meaning of these concepts. Because they've never seen virtue, concentration, and wisdom as objects, most people are bound to develop wrong views about them. When a student is unfamiliar with the terminology, the teacher must carefully explain the path of practice, step by step, and gradually build up an understanding of the basic concepts involved. However, only someone who has really mastered the practice and knows what he's talking about can teach like that. Otherwise, the teacher will be left to explain the practice according to what has been handed down in the Buddhist texts. Because of a lack of profound personal insight into the Dhamma, the teacher is using concepts that he does not fully understand himself, which easily causes misunderstanding to arise in his students as well. When practicing on one's own without a teacher, the Buddhist texts can be a very useful reference, but we should not depend on them too much. Following the texts as a guide to meditation has its drawbacks because our inexperienced minds are not equipped to unravel their deeper meaning. So we should use the technical terms in the books with caution, as it is very easy to misinterpret their intended meaning. Like any technical subject, for example, engineering, we cannot make use of the technical terms properly unless we understand their meaning relative to the whole subject. The definitions of Buddhist terms developed from ancient times are not the precise types of definitions we are used to seeing in scientific subjects, so they rely even more on a comprehensive view of the practice. Their meanings are more like descriptions that depend on background knowledge from the student in order for him to understand their significance within the context of practical training and self-transformation. They are not concepts that most of us have ready equivalents for in our memory. The only way we can find the full meaning is by experiencing it directly and seeing how it fits in with everything else, like a central piece in a jigsaw puzzle. When that piece fits in snugly all around, then you know what it means in relation to everything else. Similarly, the true meaning of the Buddhist teachings found in the suttas can be very difficult to understand simply by reading and reflecting on the translations available to us. There is no harm in reading the suttas. They are quite inspiring. But we must be careful of the language used in the English translations because the words chosen can be misleading. In most cases, the translations are made by people who do not have a proper understanding based in the practice. Because of that, the translations are not necessarily very accurate. Many aspects of the teachings cannot be understood properly until we have developed an understanding of Dhamma in our own practice. Only then can we realize the various subtleties of meaning implicit in the texts. In that case, we may clearly comprehend a profound experience here and now in the present, but the experience may be such that it does not relate to any conceptual symbol we have stored in memory. For that reason, we often cannot verbally explain experience of profound insight satisfactorily. The language is simply not there. In the Thai forest tradition, a distinction is made between sanya and panya. Sanya is traditionally translated as perception. Although that is not entirely incorrect, the best translation of sanya is memory. Panya is best translated as wisdom. The difference between the two is similar to the difference between appearance and reality, supposition and truth, or intellectual understanding and direct insight. In other words, sanya is analogous to the intellectual understanding arrived at by thinking, whereas panya is the direct knowing of essential truths. To give you an example, thoughts are usually formed in words, which are symbols stored in memory. A thought that comes up in words originates from a nucleus or seed of that thought located deep inside. When you trace the thought process back to that original seed, you will find that the entire idea expressed in that thought is contained in the seed. Thinking attempts to express that idea in a dialogue, but on a fundamental level, the idea behind that thought is complete in the seed. Realizing that, you also realize that you know the fully formed idea already, so there's no need to think about it. In fact, thinking about it at length merely dilutes the essence of it and distorts the meaning. Discursive thinking takes appearances, thinks about them, comes to an intellectual understanding, and then supposes that the understanding represents the truth. When we sit down to meditate, our tendency is to try to verify that understanding by searching for evidence of it in our experience. In other words, our search for truth is already prejudiced by our suppositions. We expect to find what we suppose to be there. We then interpret our meditation experiences in the light of that expectation. Consequently, our minds are constantly referring present moment experiences to the past, our memory of what should be there, and thus overlooking the true nature of what arises here and now. Because we have figured out in advance the nature of what should take place along the path, we want to check the validity of present moment experiences by comparing it to a conceptual understanding already formed in our minds. This is the nature of sanya, recognition, interpretation, supposition, and it's a big cause of deception. Panya, or wisdom, is knowing and understanding, but it is an active sense, as in the act of knowing or the act of understanding. Although that knowing is usually based on the Buddha's teaching, it does not rely solely on the conceptual interpretations learned beforehand to recognize the truth in meditation experiences. A thorough conceptual understanding of the teaching is useful as a background to the wisdom practice, but it should not assert itself as the main player when wisdom's direct, non-conceptual insight is active. As a spiritual training, wisdom shines a light on the nature of present moment reality in an intensely focused way which allows no time gaps for fact-checking with our intellectual understanding. This is the nature of panya, cause and effect understanding grounded in the interaction between present moment conditions. I'll end it there. It's 10:23.
Who was the author of that? I didn't catch that at the very beginning.
Oh, Ajahn Panya's The Uncommon Wisdom.
Who?
Ajahn Panya from It's the Uncommon Wisdom.
Ajahn Panya.
Yeah.
Panyavada?
Yep.
Thank you. Well, when I read that, it was really helpful, that passage, because I struggled with panya and perception and the idea that there's all these other words. Now I can't use memory. Uh-huh. It's a perception, because for me that has more of perhaps an emotional content than it's perception. And former Ajahn Sanyo also said he thinks of sanya as recognition, mm-hmm. which I thought was a helpful term too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the... it has the same root as sanya, sati. It has the same root, and it's the primary meaning is in memory.
More years, I didn't know that.
it is helpful, but the thing is, you know, we build the layers of names, labels, perceiving. Of our experience through memory, so that, you know, it's obviously a bit more complicated and layered, but that's the building blocks of how we perceive the world or through memory.
And struggling with the paucity of the English language in relation to the Pali.
Yeah.
I think as a lay person, it helps to get a broader view.
Yeah, it helps to get a... that's where having some familiarity with some of these Buddhist terminology, Buddhist conception of experience, it's helpful. Okay.